The Retirement Security Task Force. I want to thank everybody for being here and thank you again for your patience. Our agenda today really includes two items. We want to take a vote on the recommendations that are starting on page 31 of our draft report to the legislature. Before that, we want to take public testimony. And again, if anybody else would like to sign up, you're certainly welcome to do so. We have a hard deadline today of 3:45 out of deference to some of our committee members who have other obligations in their real lives. As of right now, we do not have as much public testimony as I would have anticipated, so I think we can move through this without any problem. I would like to start, before we get to public testimony, with some clarification and context. I've had a lot of conversations and emails, phone calls from people in recent days, and I think there's a little bit of confusion about what the role of this task force is and what sort of product it is that we're delivering to the legislature and what our recommendations actually mean in the context of the legislative ask to this panel. First of all, in terms of how we got here, this legislature empaneled this task force to address a large and growing crisis around retirement security. We know that the number of older adults in this state is expected to double in the next 15 years. Many have not saved adequately for retirement. Half of private sector workers in the state of Oregon do not have access to a retirement plan directly through their place of employment. Many have suggested that they would like one. We've heard that women, minorities, and employees of small businesses are disproportionately represented amongst the ranks of those who do not have adequate retirement savings. We have certainly heard that there are lots and lots of options out there in the private sector. Yet many people are still not participating in those private plans for a variety of reasons. So the legislature formed this committee to be a fact-finding committee to help inform the discussion of the state legislature, but not to create a plan or to decide on what a plan should be for the legislature. That is the prerogative of the legislature. Our goal is to really identify what the barriers are to retirement savings and identify potential strategies to overcoming those barriers. The committee is actually empaneled till 2017, and I know that came as a surprise to some members of the committee. We may or may not call you again. I think that depends largely on what sort of reaction we get from our work product at this important waypoint that we're coming up against here, where we are required to report back to the legislature in September. And so my thinking all along has been that this would be our last meeting till we have our work product to date presented to the legislature in September, and then we would wait for feedback from those who impaneled us in the first place to find out if they would like us to continue on the next steps that are suggested in the recommendations we're going to discuss later. This is a work in progress, so we have this report because the legislature had asked us to address a number of very specific questions. We've done our best based on the testimony and our recollections of that testimony to answer the questions as best as we can with the information that we have today. But as I say, it is not a final product. There is still work to be done. I want to thank Dick in particular for taking the first shot at this. It was a yeoman's effort, and a lot of it got done over the course of weekends and evenings, and I want to thank you for that and appreciate that. Kristen from my office, I want to thank you also for your tireless work on this and the work that you will undoubtedly enjoy continuing to do. For those of you reading it, please bear in mind it is a draft. So it has syntax errors, grammatical errors, typos, formatting issues. I am not taking a vote on the entirety of the report today. I think people deserve the time to thoughtfully go through it, read the tables. But what I would like committee members to do is let us know what is missing, if anything, or if there are questions or clarifications that need to take place on the overall draft, let us know. Because most of this is just reporting back facts, tables, data that was presented to this committee, either by testimony or information that was gathered and provided by members of this committee or, frankly, members of my own team. So I'd like your thoughtful responses on the totality of the report. You can provide that information by email to Jan, and what we'll do is we'll further refine it, and we'll get more final-looking copies out to you and to the public. As I say, we're voting on the recommendations on page 31. I got a number of questions for people who said, why are you looking so hard at a state-sponsored plan? And that is a fair question, and the answer is because that is what the legislature asked us to do. They asked us to look at what a state-sponsored plan would look like. They also asked us to evaluate potential public-private partnerships. And so the recommendations starting on page 31 take that into account. I want to clarify a use of a phrase that may be confusing, and legitimately so. A state-sponsored plan does not necessarily mean a state-run plan. What do I mean by that? The 529 College Savings Plan, for example, would be a good example of a state-sponsored plan that is, in fact, run through a private sector organization that specializes in college savings. So as we have discussed what a state-sponsored plan could look like, that model has sort of been hanging out there as one example of what it might look like. And in our recommendations today, we're going to be discussing the question of a similar structure, a state board of citizens impaneled by the governor and/or the legislature. They would define the attributes that we'll be discussing in the recommendation and putting together a request for proposals, which would then go out to the private sector, and there would be a competitive and accountable bidding process for that work. That is one example of what a state-sponsored public-private partnership could look like. So I just wanted to be clear, we're not jumping to the conclusion that this will be a state-run program, nor is that specifically our recommendation to the state legislature. Our recommendations are broader than that. Finally, I just want to note the obvious. There's a lot of unanswered questions. There's a lot of work that would need to still be done, and we're going to reflect that in our report to the legislature. Just a couple of the items that clearly remain unresolved and will not be resolved by September are the questions pertaining to ERISA in the Department of Labor. We heard some very good testimony on that. There has been a lot of discussion about what the cost or the administrative hassle factor would be to businesses, particularly small businesses, if we entered into some sort of a state-sponsored program at the place of employment. I believe that we need to dig deeper to more clearly understand that. There needs to be a further discussion about what sort of private sector products exist, and Bert did a good job of illustrating one example. The question is, once we agree on these attributes starting on page 31, what private sector products or programs potentially meet those criteria? And if they don't meet the criteria, are there obstacles potentially created by the state or the federal government that stand in the way of them being able to meet those criteria? I believe that's a legitimate question that the legislative body will ask, and I think ultimately those questions need to be answered. And then, of course, there's been much discussion about education and information. We have different opinions about the relative importance of that, but I think we all agree that that is a component of this, and there's been lots of good ideas suggested via email and letters on how that could look, and I think we should include those as examples in our final draft report. And finally, there's been a number of discussions around tax incentives, and just the other day somebody suggested what I thought was sort of an interesting, unique tax incentive program. We haven't really delved too deeply into that at all, and again, that's something I would put on the list for further discussion. So With those clarifications, unless I made no sense whatsoever and people want to ask questions about what I just said, I think we'll open this up for public comment with the understanding of what this report actually now is. And first on the list I have...
Hey, can I just ask a couple clarifying questions just to make sure?
Yeah.
So on getting back to Jan on the body of the document...
Please.
By the end of the month, by the end of next week, you know, what time frame are you looking
at? Kristen, what works for you?
Okay.
Can we say 2 weeks? And if that doesn't work, obviously we can be flexible, but that'll give us time to get it back out to the committee. Ultimately, everybody's name goes on this, so I want people to be satisfied with the work product as much as possible. I might as well mention this now as well in our discussions on the recommendations. I don't assume everybody's going to agree on everything. And so I had mentioned to Jan prior to the meeting, I think it's important to capture dissenting opinions and rationale for dissenting opinions and include that in the body of the report as well. So we could say, for example, well, most people agreed on whatever, let's say auto-enroll, but some task force members were concerned about the prospect of X. I think that's fair and legitimate to provide that level of information to the legislature so that they know there are different perspectives and interests on these things.
Okay. And then can I ask one other question?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, of course, Harley. Yeah.
And Jan, when you sent this out to the task force, was it in a Word document or was it in a...
It's a PDF. I believe I sent it as a PDF.
So is it possible to get a Word just so I can then do edits within the document versus trying to write everything down and...
Yes.
We can eat. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Chair, I'd just add that for reporting to the legislature, legislative days are September 15th through the 17th, and those would be good dates to consider being available to make the report to the appropriate committees. And I believe it would be House Business and Labor and Senate Business and Transportation. They both meet on that Monday morning, September 15th at 8 in the morning.
Oh, great.
But those chairs, as Chair Byer...
What other committees you got?
late Friday afternoon. The chairs will decide if that is something that they want to add to the agenda, but I would expect that that will be the case.
It is possible they could simply ask for the report. And... that would fulfill our obligation for the September. More than likely, they'll want to hear something and ask some questions, would be my guess.
So are we saying the 20th, then, is the time for the committee people to get things back?
To you?
Two weeks.
Yeah.
20th from today.
20th.
Okay. Good. Yeah, thanks for that clarification, Dick. First up, Jerry Cohen. And did you want to come up with Edward Brewington?
Sure.
Okay, great. And Stephen, you're coming up separately, is that correct? We have plenty of flexibility. There's only five people signed up. Good. Thank you, gentlemen. And if you could state your name for the record, we'd appreciate it.
My name is Jerry Cohen, and I'm State Director AARP here in Oregon. And I live in Lake Oswego. So a representative is my representative.
I am Edward Brewington, AARP volunteer. I also live in Lake Oswego.
Thank you.
Several constituents. So anyway. Chair and Treasurer Wheeler and esteemed members of this task force, thank you. Our remarks are going to be brief. I just want to hit a couple of quick points. First, per page 3, I would suggest a slight change. AARP, we're an ally for real possibilities. We're no longer, or have we been for a while, the American Association of Retired Persons. We're not retiring souls, believe it or not. And in fact, while we're talking about retirement security, a lot of that is because many of our members age 50 plus aren't retired, which, ergo, the name change. But I also want to accentuate the real possibilities frame that AARP uses now, because what you've offered up in the report and recommendations really does indeed offer up real possibilities for today and tomorrow's Oregonians. Our members, as we look at age 50 plus, are very concerned as much about their kids and their grandkids. And I can just speak as a father of a millennial who, at the moment, fortunately, has a 401k, but most of her friends do not. So just to accentuate that point. The other quick points are as follows. One, that we know is complicated and confusing, and it's important to do education, is any type of investment and savings can be the simpler and the more understandable we can make the process and system, which the recommendations address or seek to address, we think is very vital. Third, this is a middle class issue. Almost a year ago this time, and I've submitted for the record, AARP stood side by side with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, declaring this very issue and concern of the lack of savings, the devolution of our middle class today and tomorrow. So looking at this is truly an intergenerational issue. And again, this is one piece of the puzzle. This is by no means a panacea when it comes to the inequities in terms of income and savings for all Oregonians. Certainly we're talking about those that would like to and have an ability to save but don't currently really have that which we're talking about, as well as the opportunity to opt out rather than opt in. So I'm going to just end with 2 points. One, I didn't want to go into need. I think you all understand need all too well for the savings. But the biggest need here is what you're providing to date, and that is bold leadership. So we endorse support all of the effort and work as leaders and as champions that you are providing to Oregon and indeed the nation. We're one of 17 or 19 states now looking and trying to tackle this issue, but we're frankly way ahead of most states. So my end is tickled by Treasurer Wheeler having spoken 2 days ago at another issue of investment in infrastructure. It was on transportation. And you spoke to bridges, and it tickled me in terms of remembering an AARP volunteer leader. When I moved here, we were one of the first state offices, and he was concerned about his kids and grandkids. And he gave me a poem by Will Drumgooley, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the bridge builder. So quickly as follows, an old man going lone highway came at the evening cold and gray to a chasm vast and deep and wide through which was flowing a sullen tide. The old man crossed in the twilight dim. The sullen stream had no fears for him, but he turned when safe on the other side and built a bridge to span the tide. Old man, said a fellow pilgrim near, you are wasting strength with building here. Your journey will end with a ending day, and you never again must pass this way. You've crossed a chasm deep and wide. Why build you a bridge at the eventide? The builder lifted his old gray head. Good friend, in the path I have come, he said, there followeth after me today a youth whose feet must pass this way. This chasm that has been naught to me, to that fair-haired youth may a pitfall be. He too must cross into twilight dim. Good friend, I'm building the bridge for him. And I leave you with those words and turn to Edward Brewington.
Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you, Jerry. Well, I'm not nearly as poetic as Jerry. But I want to thank you, Chairman Wheeler, and the committee for giving me a chance to address you this afternoon. I would tell you that as a retired business executive and currently an educator, as well as an AARP volunteer, I sort of come at this from different perspectives. I've had and still have the privilege of participating in a number of retirement plans. I've also, thank goodness, college 529 plans, sending my daughters to college currently. So I understand the value of having savings for the future, for retirement. Unfortunately, through my volunteer efforts, I've also encountered many people who have no such plans in place. And looking at their quality of life or the poor quality of life, it reinforces the importance of having some vehicle in place for them to plan more effectively for the future. So I had a chance to come to several of your committee meetings, and I read the report this morning. I also learned this morning that I would be addressing you instead of playing tennis, Harley. I would say that looking at the report, I realize there's a lot of work that has to be done. But from my perspective, I think the quality of your work is really outstanding. I think that you have created a report that's comprehensive. I think it highlights many of the important issues as well as possible courses of action going forward. So clearly you have my support, you have the support of the organization which I represent. I'd like to, however, reemphasize something I feel strongly about, and this will be no surprise considering I'm currently an educator, and that is on your recommendation on page 31, when you talk about education, one of the comments is the board will work with the education system. And I would just like to emphasize a point that I think is critically important. That system, I believe, has to be broad-based. and not just rely on educational organizations. I think it has to include the private sector, the public sector. I think it has to include all levels of educational organizations. And very importantly, I think it should engage the services of the many organizations in the state of Oregon that are dedicated to improving the quality of life of Oregonians. We have a very broad network, and we need to, I think, consider using that network as we attempt to educate the public. I'll say more about education in a second. I think that for a successful outcome, and I realize education is sort of an umbrella statement, but in reality, one of the things I think we recognize is that when you talk about anything, whether it's a tool or a piece of machinery or a program or whatever, you must create a sense of why this is important in the minds of people. And after the why, it's, well, then how do you use it? And too often we tend to overlook that. We're very proud of our administrative component that says this is great and it works this way, but somehow we don't reach the individual. And I call on Professor Cotter at Harvard, who says in order to effect change, we must see it, we must feel it, and then we change. And Bert, my compliments to you, because in your presentation, I remember you said, make them feel the need and they will come. And I think the feeling part is something that is something a great challenge for us and that will require attention going forward. So those are my comments. I thank you and wish you good luck as you go forward.
I appreciate that very much. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Next on the list, Stephen Michael. Hello again.
Good to see you. Thanks very much, Stephen Michael, the State Director for the Main Street Alliance of Oregon. We work with about 2,500 small businesses and small business owners from across the state. This is an issue that's near and dear to a lot of our members' hearts. We've, you know, submitted a lot of our data over surveying and talking to business owners one-on-one over the past few years. And that's thankfully, you know, from our perspective, including your report as well. I just wanted to thank you all for your work and for your efforts on this. This is definitely a very, very important issue. Speaking from my own generation, you know, this is something where, you know, we're graduating from college with massive amounts of student debt, and thinking about planning for retirement is something that's so far beyond even tomorrow's thought, or the next day's thought, or the next year's thought. And so making sure that in the education aspect of this, making sure that we're reaching youth early and really talking about how this is a very, very important aspect to be able to plan for your future is just instrumental to the success of our economy long term and our communities long term. And that would actually get to the point of the importance of a simple system and the importance of auto enrollment from the business perspective and from employees' perspective too. I started working when I was 15 years old, and if I had an auto enroll retirement plan that was coming out of my paycheck from 15, that would be 12 years that I would have already been saving, and that's the magic that of compound interest that we've learned about would have immensely helped me. And then by this time in my professional career, that would be just commonplace. It's something that you just know is just coming out. You know that that's going to be there. And so it's about building that long-term appreciation, building that knowledge. From the small business perspective, making sure that we know that this is something that's going to be easy to administer, making sure that this is something that's going to be simple and easy to use and portable for our employees is just something instrumental to the success of anything moving forward. So thank you all very, very much for your time so far, and we look forward to seeing what there is to come.
Thank you. Let's see, John Mangan and Lisa Blyer. You may, absolutely, as long as you state your name for the record, it all gets in there.
Thank you, Chair Wheeler and members of the task force. My name is John Mangan. I'm the Regional Vice President of the American Council of Life Insurers. That's a national trade group of life insurance companies such as Standard that offer individual and group employer retirement products across the state and across the country. And we're delighted to be here to have a chance to speak just briefly. Again, we want to applaud the task force for making this a leadership issue in our state, because we spend all of our time and effort, our whole careers really, trying to convince people to establish plans and trying to convince individuals to sign up for plans and increase their savings. So the whole charter of this task force is something we support completely. But today, I just want to focus briefly on the draft report of recommendations that we just saw today. And a couple of comments, really, in addition to the comments that we presented this morning, and I'm speaking in part on behalf of NAFA, NFIB, and the CIFMA organization, and ACLI as well. We thought today was going to be talking about some ideas or recommendations for public discussion, and so that's why we gave you a list of our potential recommendations. They include some educational components, some small business targeted components, some public-private partnerships where we would actually work with you as the treasurer or with anyone else to go out and reach out to small employers directly and try to enroll them under the leadership and encouragement that you could give us. We also recommended two specific tax credits that are, they're frankly mirrors of what's already available at the federal level, but which could be cloned or modified for use in the state of Oregon. One is essentially a low to middle income tax savers credit, which provides incentives especially for first-time savers and for people at lower income levels. The details of that tax credit are in our submission. They're pretty well fleshed out, and we think it's pretty effective at the federal level, something you could consider in Oregon. Oregon, as you know, has a high income tax rate, so for individual savers, a credit of that type could be valuable. It has costs, of course, too, but we think it could be one of the tools that you consider rationally and see if it's something that could work. The other one, of course, is a credit for small employers. We know that a lot of the focus of the task force has been on small business, rightfully so. The task force charter actually includes, though, encouraging individuals as well to save in the individual market. That's something we didn't see much of in the report. It mostly focuses on the group side. But the credit for small business could be, we could make businesses aware of that at the time they get their business license in the state of Oregon, and we could offer a credit that would subsidize to some degree the establishment of their plan. If they were willing to put one together at the beginning of their business life, they could get a small credit over a period of time that you would determine. We think that could be effective. Again, it's modeled on a federal tax credit. So we submit those for your consideration. We hope that you might consider including them in the report of recommendations. If you decide not to, we understand, but we thought we'd put them on the table. The other thing I just wanted to mention for the group is that we noticed there's some missing things in the report. A lot of the research and items that we submitted are not referenced and not included. So we did provide a lot of information about the debt load of Americans, what the obstacles are to savings, debt, lack of income, lack of job security, part-time work. Those studies from Price Waterhouse and other studies about small business activity in this market from the GAO were not referenced, so we were just surprised that none of that research made it into the report. We would encourage you to take another look at that over the next couple weeks. We're happy to pinpoint some of those things for your review if you'd like us to. And finally, I think just a brief note on the final recommendation that's in the report. It looks like to us that the recommendation to sponsor, or whatever the word is, a state plan for employers using an auto enrollment feature, which we all agree is a very effective way to get people signed up in an ERISA governed plan. We think that the components of that plan could trigger coverage by ERISA. We were very interested in the commentary on June 10th from the DOL staff. You asked them a lot of terrific questions, and they basically said to you, you know, if you're going to go down a path like that, those features could trigger ERISA coverage, and we strongly encourage you to ask us for an opinion. Before you go forward and start doing that, it would be wise, and we just totally agree with that. We think to clear up that question, if there's a belief that ERISA doesn't apply and there won't be burdens on employers, and that's part of the charge of the task force, is that you not recommend something that does that, then the best way to clear that up is simply to take the components of your plan that you have sketched out and submit that to the Department of Labor for an opinion as to, you know, would these features trigger coverage in your opinion. We think that'd be a great starting point. You'd have an answer. It would certainly, I think, change the dynamic in terms of legislators as well who are looking at that question. So those are my comments. I'm happy to turn it over to my colleague at CIFMA.
Thank you, John. And I don't make a habit of commenting on public comment. But given the substantive nature of your comments and the time and energy you put into putting together the draft, I might just take a few moments if the committee would indulge me here. First of all, with regard to ERISA, I want to be clear that at least I agree with you wholeheartedly. I do think it would be irresponsible for us to actually implement any plan without understanding whether or not that plan is legal and acceptable. And of course, the legislature specifically asked us not to ascribe any liability either to the state or private sector employers under the ERISA Act. So that is an issue I just want to be very clear. We agree that that needs further discussion and evaluation. With regard to the substantive recommendations, I wasn't really sure, fellow task force members, how to include substantive recommendations that we get today. And so I'd like to offer an option. And maybe if we could just take a mini break to, you can stay here, but maybe we could just sort of pull the committee. As I read your ideas, I think they were on the two tax credit recommendations, and I believe there were three education and information recommendations for further study. They all made good logical sense to me in terms of being items for further evaluation and discussion and potentially professional testimony as well. So my thinking was, if the committee would find it acceptable, that we, when we get to the recommendation, that there should be information and education, which I'm going to take a guess, probably most of us agree with that, we could put some bullets under that saying, and we receive testimony or examples during committee hearings, including the following, that are worthy of further deliberation and discussion. Does that seem like a reasonable approach? Bert, what do you think?
Anything helps, because it seemed to be a lot of foregone conclusions. You know, and there's some points I didn't agree with. And I think we may be a little premature. If we don't have the ERISA thing cleared up, we're doing a lot for nothing.
Well, I think we just need to be, well, that's entirely true. That is a possibility, that we get to the end of the process, and under the requirements put forth by the legislature, we can't meet those requirements, nor can we recommend anything that meets those requirements. But we're not going to have that question answered by September. That was very obvious based on the testimony we heard from the Department of Labor. It sounds like there's a process that one must undertake, and unfortunately it's not a straightforward, simple process.
So we've got to come up with something.
We need to be honest with the legislative body that the recommendations we're making are contingent upon favorable findings from the Department of Labor, which we can't make any representations one way or the other. At least I don't feel comfortable. Yes.
Well, I think you're both making a great point, and I'm pleased that it seems like that's captured on page 31.
I believe it is.
You know, that says that one of our recommendations is to verify that essentially this sketch doesn't implicate ERISA. I think that's a great point, but I feel like we have incorporated that.
Yeah, I mean, I've said on the record it would be irresponsible for us to implement a plan without the ERISA question being answered. I mean, so there. Yeah. I hope everybody understands that we can't take people's money and put it into a retirement plan not knowing that it is a legal plan. That would be irresponsible.
And I feel like we got guidance from the folks who came in and testified from DOL that we have to give them something of a sketch of what the idea is before we ask the question of whether it's okay. So I think it's a tough issue and sort of a case of first impression, but I feel like we've tried to incorporate all that in what we have in the draft. I really like the tax credit points that you were making, and I think, you know, consistent with what you were saying, Mr. Chair, Mr. Treasurer, about adding a little bit of content, you know, I would be open to augmenting the bit that says request that the legislature consider offering tax credits to offset the cost to employers, to also note, you know, to incentivize participation in the program by workers or by, you know, prospective savers. I mean, that doesn't ask and answer exactly what it looks like and exactly how we pay for it, but it's important stuff. You know, we need incentives both to help people do it and to help people participate and save. And so as a task force member, but also as a legislator, I think it'd be great for us to
let's do this then to respect the testimony, if it's the will of the committee. When we get to the discussion points, if you could remember your language, and I will suggest that we include four examples that we have heard through public testimony for further evaluation. And I also just want to call it, you've offered to continue to assist and participate, and I appreciate and respect that.
You bet.
Thank you. Lisa, sorry.
Yes, thank you. Chair Wheeler and members of the committee, I'm Lisa Blyer with the Securities Industry Financial Markets Association. So one of the areas I wanted to just briefly touch on is some of the things that are being worked on at the federal level that I think very well could address many of the issues that were raised in this report that I think you should definitely give due consideration to. Among the options that are being worked on are things such as multiple employer plans. They're called MEPs. There's bipartisan support for it on Capitol Hill. We've been working on this in Washington, D.C. And so it's just in the process, but it is something they're working on that would help allow multiple smaller employers to pool together. Various other increased savings incentives that are always regularly are introduced. But then also the president in the State of the Union address raised the MyRA, and that is something that we have been supporting for many years. I personally have worked on it both at this job and my previous job, which was with the American Bankers Association. It's also engaged in this issue. We've been working on this for a while because we've been trying to address the many issues that have been raised. As we try to make it work. So it would be a government run, or will be. It actually will start later this year. The pilot program will be begin before the end of 2014. Be a government run, small starting accounts. The accounts would only need to be $25. They would be set up as a Roth. Therefore, if somebody later pulls the money out, there's no additional penalties. There would be no burden on the employers, and there would be no ERISA implications. And additionally, because it would be a federally run program, if somebody lives currently in Oregon and then moves to Idaho, moves to the state of Washington, they can take it with them. It doesn't matter whether the one state has something or puts something in place and another state does not. This will always be portable. And this is something we strongly support at this program, and actually most of the financial services trade associations do strongly support this program, and we'd be happy to help promote it. So I just thank you for taking the time to listen.
Thank you. Appreciate you.
Question?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, of course, Bert.
What's the cap once they reach a certain amount?
So the way they set it up is that once you hit $15,000, you will be encouraged or pushed out. The idea is that if somebody can get to $15,000, since these are going to start very small, right, you're talking about somebody who might not be making as much money to begin with and starting them very small. But the idea is that once they get to something around $15,000, then there is enough money that they can be in some types of investment options that would actually allow them to really be saving for retirement. I think we all agree $15,000 is not going to be enough for somebody to live off of once they hit 65 for X number of years. So the idea is that once they hit that number, they would be encouraged to move into the private sector. And what Treasury is going to do is they're going to put out a request for information to get ideas as to how to make that rollout, that part work. But in the interim, since they know it'll take a while to get to that $15,000, they are going to start the plan, start this program, and it will start at the end of this year. And then they're going to request comments regarding how they're going to do that aspect of it.
And it will at least be teaching people to start saving.
Yes, absolutely. And the hope is that once they see that they have money in the account, they will let it stay there and continue to grow.
Thank you. Lisa, is that done through payroll deduction?
No, it will not. Well, yes, actually, it will be done through payroll deduction. The employers, they're working with the employers, so they have chosen to opt in to this program. It's a choice by the employer. It is not a mandate on the employers, so they've chosen to participate, and it will be through a payroll deduction. So you do have buy-in from the employers, which is really one of the key things, is to get the buy-in that the employers are choosing to join this program.
Thank you.
And the hope is that actually if they join it through this smaller piece, maybe eventually they'll realize, oh, my employees understand what this is and they understand the benefit, so maybe I want to actually offer them a more substantial plan.
Very good. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Chair Wheeler, and members of the task force. My name is Jan Meekums, the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. We have been the voice of small business for 71 years, with 350,000 members nationwide and 7,500 members throughout the state of Oregon. And these are this bill will impact many of our members. We appreciate the problem that the state of Oregon is electing to take up. It is a problem. And if it doesn't get solved, it will impact our future business owners who have to bear the burden along with the rest of the state on how do we take care of these people that are in poverty. So we appreciate the problem and we want to be part of the solution. It is one of the largest items of angst amongst our members when we discuss this state retirement system facilitated through them if it is a mandated type of program. And it looks like we're not there, which we're happy to hear. Because I appreciate in recommendations that you seek from employers information on the direct cost of processing enrollment and payroll deductions described above, but there are costs outside of the direct cost. There's the time issue. There's a liability issue. So there are things that are outside of that. So we would like to be included in this conversation when you do address the small employer and how it impacts them. We think education is very important. We very much support and the recommendations regarding education piece addressing this issue. There's been reference since the beginning of the 529 plan. It is a state-sponsored plan, but it's not facilitated through the employer. That is what makes it very different than what's under discussion today. And we are really enthused about MIRA. So many of our small employers and even self-employed, they do not have a savings plan along with their employees. And we would love to be part of the solution, the education process, and support and facilitate something that can get people into the saving mode, can train them into the saving mode, and move them out into a more robust savings vehicle for retirement. And we see that as a solution. And it's something that Oregon doesn't have to do. It's already done for them. So we're excited about how that is going to evolve and move out, and MEPS as well. We have a lot of small employers that if they could pool their situation with other employers and offer something. So there's some things being done that more easily we can support and facilitate than some of the things that we're looking at now. The report is, appreciate the report, like your openness and your willingness to address all of the issues that our members see as a problem. And thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony. Anybody else? Last call for public testimony. Yes, ma'am. And is there anybody else? Great. If you just state your name for the record, please.
Chair Wheeler and members of the committee, my name is Marcia Kelly, and I'm the advocate for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. We're pleased with the majority of the report, which I've had a very quick chance to glance at. I would be concerned with any program that requires the opt-in from the employer, because that's part of the reason we have less savings nowadays. I like the idea of going down to very, very small employers. And from the aspect of the time and commitment for something that is an opt-in by the employee and is facilitated through the payroll system of the employer, having been one of those myself for 2.5 to 3 employees, the majority of the 10 years that I was the managing partner, adding one item onto the line and paying the taxes is not going to take an additional amount of time on a monthly basis or a quarterly basis to do. It should be very simple if it would be through the payroll system. I did it for 10 years. There's software out there that the state provides to employers for facilitating the taxes and unemployment and workers' comp, and it doesn't take a whole bunch of time. The one thing that might take some time is the definition of regular reports about how much is in their account, whether that would be something on the state or something on the employer.
Question?
Yes, sir.
Asha, you mentioned something that's dear to me, payroll deduction. Would you be a person who would support the idea? What if you had 10 employees, 10 of them went out and purchased IRA accounts from XYZ insurance, banks, whatever, but you were obligated by law to have a payroll slot and do the paperwork to subtract it each month? Would that be adverse, more paperwork? It didn't sound like it was.
I think that I would be adverse to the idea that we're going to have 10 employees who are all 10 going to go out and do their own individual IRAs, because I don't think that the time commitment is what. Part of the thing is the time commitment right now. And I think that if people want to do their own IRAs on their own, that is perfectly fine. But I don't think the majority of our minimally employed workers who have many other things on their plate that they have to do are going to take the time to do an individual IRA. And I think it's more complex than what to do the individual IRA, and I think that something that would facilitate retirement, which is closely akin to Social Security, would be more understandable and easier for a majority of workers to be able to do.
However, one of our main focuses is ways to get to the money before the employee spends it. So you would see it as a burden to a point on a small business. What if it was limited to 5 slots as opposed to 10 or 20 or something, 5 carriers?
I have a problem with spending the ability of both the employer and the employee taking the time to figure out the slots. I think it's one of the things that it would be good for basically women who oftentimes are more on and off of employment to be able to know for sure that when they're employed they have money coming out. It would be nice to be able to have them be able to put something in when they're not in the workforce, but at least to know that when they're employed they have something coming out. When you have multiple employers, the employer has a choice. Having the employer have the choice is not, in my estimation, facilitating individual responsibility for being able to maintain that. And it also means that the employer is then controlling the ability of someone who may be not making a whole bunch of money to save money if the employer has to make that choice. And I think that the more complicated you make it, the harder it is to achieve the goals. It's sort of like keeping it very simple so that people can explain it. I have been an elected official for 25 years, and trying to explain the property tax in the state of Oregon to my constituents is infinitely difficult, and I have been through countless discussions on how it works, and it is still very hard. So keeping it simple is the easiest way to make the progress we would like to make.
Thank you, Marcia, for your testimony, and thank you for not going into compression.
All right, good. Without further ado, just to reiterate what I said earlier, obviously I'd like people to take the next 2 weeks. Hopefully you'll have a chance to read it before then. Look at the totality of the report, the graphs, the charts. Kristen, will you also work with John on the data that he felt was missing from the report? It sounded it was probably in the interest of brevity, but I certainly have no objections to that being included in the body of the report. Could we turn, please, to page 31? And what I'd propose, just in the interest of, we sort of had a deliberation amongst staff members about whether we wanted to have a drafting party or not. And so what I would propose is this, that there are, I believe, five sections, characteristics, governance, and management, next steps. So I was off by one. That's probably fairly common. If we could take a look at the sections as a whole, and so we'll start with characteristics. And again, I want people to read the sentence above that that leads the recommendations, so I'll read it out loud. To reach, extend, and improve retirement savings participation by Oregonians, the state of Oregon should sponsor, that's the word they use, the creation and development of a general retirement program available to any Oregonian who does not have immediate access to a retirement savings program through their employer. And then we have blocked this out as characteristics, potential governance and management, and potential next steps. So,
Chairman, can I just ask a question?
Yes, sir.
And I don't want to derail this, but I was struggling with that paragraph and what's on the executive summary. The legislation directed the task force to, which says, develop recommendations for increasing the percentage of Oregonians saving for retirement or enrolled in a retirement plan and for increasing the amount of those individual savings. And what I'm worried about is we're still missing a section of the population that is not employed or is not having a, you know, they could be individually employed, that won't be covered based on what we're trying to do here. So, I don't want to rat hole, but I've been struggling with that since this came out. So,
fair comment. Discussion?
Are you asking?
Go ahead. Yeah, absolutely.
So, I think that we have previously aligned around the idea that we want, say, women who are, you know, people who are caregiving and so not currently being paid, but who may come in and out of the workforce to have the opportunity to put money away. They have access to some resource. So it doesn't expressly include that group of people, but it doesn't expressly exclude them. I would love it if we could put in some language that acknowledges this product would be open to people who may not be currently employed, but who, you know, somehow to make it very clear that we're trying to get at that issue, because that's one of the big reasons why women end up with inadequate retirement savings, because they're not always in the workforce, but we want to help that. And I feel like that's what you were talking about.
Well, that's part of it. And then it's also all the independent contractors, right? You know, we have a large amount of small businesses that are one person,
sure,
and they don't have a payroll system.
Fair enough.
Though they're self-employed, right?
Right.
So in that regard, it is covered, the self-employed.
So Ann or Harley, would you like to make some recommendations in terms of how to encompass that?
Can I ask a question for clarification?
You bet.
If somebody is moving in and out of the workforce, then is the issue that they should, if they're between work or between employers, they could still make their own contribution? Or is it people who are never in the workforce and or both?
Well, I was thinking of the category of people who are in and out, and so probably start one of these at a point when they're in, which is presumably before they have kids, mm-hmm. and then step out for a while and come back in and step back out, and it would meet a need that I see if people could continue contributing while they're out.
That's what I thought you were saying,
yeah.
But I just wanted to make sure. Yeah. So then any recommendation should is it the suggestion that any recommendation would say they can continue to contribute in between employment if they're already
Or if people are between employment, think of all the people who in the last 7 years got laid off.
Yeah.
You know, and so not just people caring for children or elderly family members, you know, anybody who's out of a job for a while but somehow has ongoing desire to contribute. Yeah.
So should they be, if they're not yet employed, should they be able to open an account and then get work and then continue through payroll deduction? Or should they have to be employed somewhere first, start an account, and then if they're between work, they could make their own, continue to make their own contributions?
Well, Harley, if you want to jump in, please do. But, you know, in the problem that I was trying to think through, it is for people who've been employed at some point, which is almost everyone by the time they hit 18, you know, during the whole period before they're permanently retired. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's administratively much more difficult to start something up before someone's ever had their first job, but I would be inclined, if we're talking about how to get from here to that language, to see if we agree on that direction, if Kristen, you know, in her capacity as a really smart lawyer who's helping draft this, could just come up with language that meets that need rather than me trying to prescribe specific words. But, you know, I defer to you guys on what makes sense.
I think finding a way that we can not make it too complicated. So it's not the trying to figure out who's in and out of the workplace and how long were you out and did you have an employer that had one and was it part of this program or was it a private? I think that's where it's going to start getting complicated. But the question of whether or not you're employed in order to get in, I think if we look at the charge and we look at this wording, the wording could still include people who are not currently employed because they don't have access to a retirement plan by an employer, but increasing the number of Oregonians who are saving, I think, does mean that we need to be looking at people who could get access to this program and are not currently employed. I'm thinking about even what Jerry was talking about, all of these folks that are concerned about their kids. That's a graduation present sometimes that people are starting up a Roth IRA for their kid. Could they buy into this and get their kids started? Who knows where their income is coming from or when they're going to start getting that job, but is there a way that people could get into a retirement plan in this way that would then automatically link to an employer as soon as they became employed? Could go both ways then. But to keep it from getting too complicated of when you start being linked to a particular point of employment, particularly as we look at youth jobs and the struggle of getting youth in jobs right now is particularly high in Oregon.
So if I could comment on that, Elaine, and thank you, Harley, for raising this. This is actually a really good call on your part. As long as we're blue-skying this, and we are, it opens up some really cool intergenerational opportunities here. So I'd call on somebody else who's a better wordsmith. You don't want the state treasurer wordsmithing your documents, trust me.
I do have a suggestion then. The bullet lower down where it says employee accounts will be portable, if we put a comma there, for example, and said including employees in between employment who may continue to make contributions, that gets at part of what the discussion is.
Or individuals.
Right.
It could.
Yeah, because I think
it's not an employee right. necessarily.
That I'm assuming that each individual is going to have their individual account and their individual account number, and that it's hard to imagine that there's going to be whatever the association or the company, the entity is, that you would only be able to initiate an account through an employer, and that there wouldn't also be the opportunity to, as an individual, to initiate an account, to open an account in your name, and that account would follow you to an employer, it would follow you when you're not employed, it would, you know, that. So that would be an awfully
so it might make sense, just because we're way over our skis on this, to include, you know, that this would be a desirable outcome? Because I have no idea. I mean, if I were a trust lawyer, my head would probably be spinning talking about grand ideas about grandparents contributing to somebody else's.
Right.
I think it's a good idea and a good thought. And Harley, you're certainly right that I think the intention here of the legislature would have been people moving in and out of the workforce, just as Anne has suggested. Kristen, what are you? Are you working on some language over there? Oh, look at this. Somebody just gave me a piece of paper. Program should be available to people not currently employed.
It's very broad, but these are broad.
Well,
broad recommendations,
and picking on somebody.
I would have to say that the recommendations are not to the detail that, like, for example, the recommendation about the amount that will be automatically deducted, that's not determined in this report. Is it 3%? Is it 1%? There are a lot of details that aren't, on purpose, are not laid out.
So I don't disagree. I appreciate that simplicity. I guess I'm still concerned about, we have a lot of independent contractors in the state of Oregon. And I guess I'm wondering, how does that population get captured in this? Do they get captured in this? And a lot of them aren't making a lot of money. You know, they're...
Kristen's going to come save us, Harley.
Okay.
Okay, I'm sorry. There's a couple different suggestions that I might include.
Okay.
And for the record, I'm Kristen Johnson with the Treasurer's Office. Under the bullet point on recommendations, the one that reads, request that the legislature consider offering tax credits to offset the cost to employers. I would amend that to say, and to individuals who are self-employed, or you could include independent contractors.
Where's
that? Does that capture at least part of it?
Kristen, could you be, where is that?
Under the recommendation, under the next steps.
Yes.
The bullet that starts with request that the legislature consider offering tax credits.
Page 33.
Yeah, I suggest expanding that to include, to incentivize independent contractors. So that's part of the piece.
But that's only with reference to tax credits and cost offsets. I think the sentence we're actually dealing with deals with everything. Anne?
You know, I think it's a cruel thing for us to ask anyone to draft on the fly. So I just want to sort of have that blanket apology to anyone who's been trying to help us draft on the fly. I like, and I don't know who originated it, that pretty 10,000-foot level sentence that Jan read a few minutes ago. There are a huge number of questions that still have to be answered, and any of this is subject to it being legal. But I think that the breadth of that sentence, which I didn't write down.
I got it right here. Program should be available to people not currently employed.
I think when you marry up that with the fact that, you know, it's available to the self-employed, which is one way that people are independent contractors, we encompass the categories of people that we were just talking about wanting to encompass. Exactly the mechanics of how that works, I think, remains to be determined, but a lot remains to be determined by the legislature. So my personal preference would be to go more with that sentence and then to ask the forgiveness of Kristen for us kind of asking her to draft on the fly and putting that bullet point somewhere in characteristics, somewhere where it fits,
okay.
And that gets it done.
Like it.
Good, Harley?
Okay.
I'm there.
Good. Excellent. Okay. And Kristen, I'll give you this. Do you want to sign this?
It's a super important piece of tiny paper. Could you read it?
Thanks, Kristen.
What did it say?
That's good. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Call security.
Okay. So we're through the first sentence. We did it. No, Bert?
Where are we?
We're now starting with characteristics. The entire. Let me do it this way.
So we're in the education part yet.
No,
we're not. So hold off on education. So right now, what I'm asking everybody to do is look at the entirety of the bullet points under the heading characteristics, which is all of the remainder of page 31. And when we're done looking at that, and if anybody has made changes and those changes have been included, then I'm going to ask us to take a vote of
assent, or maybe I'll just ask if there are any objections to what we've got, and then we'll move on to the next section.
I have something for 30
Please,
for characteristics.
And then Dick.
That we've talked about, and yet I find it not in here, and I understand it's complex in the way other ERISA things are, but I would like to have a sense of the body that there is important value to finding a way for employers to participate, to match in some way or other, for employers to participate in this in a way that doesn't compromise the program, you know, that something obviously that needs to be investigated, that needs to be put out there, but I would like a sense of the group that we would like, that we think it's important to include the opportunity for employers to contribute. I mean, what in small businesses like mine are at a significant disadvantage with larger employers, not always on wages and benefits, but on the retirement aspects. I mean, we personally lose out to PGE and TriMet and these, because especially as somebody gets a little older and gets older than Stephen, and they then you know they look at what's being offered, and that becomes much more important. And so I'm looking for ways to enhance, to help level the playing field for small businesses in that way. So I'd like to find a way to include that.
Would that not be a question to include if we adopt the other parts about getting verification from ERISA?
But if we don't ask it, it won't be. If we don't include it, it won't be asked. And that's all I'm saying. I want it to be included here so that it's a sense of the group that we think it's important and something important to take to ERISA.
So is that looking at the bullet, there will be no required employer contribution, but there would be
the opportunity
for it. Would be.
Exactly. Thank you.
Nice. Nice to have something along those lines.
Can we just say investigate or
yeah.
Investigate the opportunity for employers to participate.
And you'd recommend that after the bullet, there will be no required employer
contribution. That seemed like a reasonable place.
Or couple it with that.
Okay. Yeah. Good.
So, go ahead, Ann.
I see this the same way that you do, that we want to be very careful that we wouldn't somehow sink the rest of the work product by implicating ERISA if that does. But if it's allowed and someone voluntarily wants to make employer contribution,
exactly.
that we certainly wouldn't be standing in the way of that. But we want to be very clear that it's not a poison pill, and if for some reason that's not allowed,
there may well be someone out there who's got a great idea on how to make that happen without infringing on the ERISA, and I want to put that opportunity out there for somebody to come to the legislature or to a board or somebody and say, we figured out a way to do that.
Not to be the naysayer in this group, but the way that the automatic enrollment is in direct conflict with ERISA. As it's stated in law today. So one of the things that I would say for us to think about is currently we have on the books ORS 652.610, which is a wage and hour law that goes back in time that doesn't allow for, it prohibits deducting any funds for an employee's paychecks without the employee's prior written approval. The federal law in 2006 overrode that, but when we start thinking about if we want to move this forward, that is one of the things we're going to have to come and figure out how we either modify or change or get rid of or something on the books. So,
doesn't the opportunity to opt out, I mean, it seems in my mind, an opportunity to opt out would satisfy that. The employee would not be giving their, if they say, look, I don't want to be in it, then they've been given the opportunity, and if they're silent, if they say fine, then they're given their assent.
Yeah, it's one of the things that we're going to have to be very specific when we ask for it, for a review from the DOL.
Agreed.
Just because ERISA, it's
pretty firm about that concept.
Do you want that explicitly called out, Harley, in next steps?
I think whatever gets proposed to take to the DOL, I think you have to address it somehow.
Did you get the statute reference, Kristen?
I didn't get the reference.
It was ORS.
ORS 652.610.
Say it one more time.
652.610.
Thanks, Harley.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Jan.
Was there agreement about the employer contribution? If so, can I suggest some language?
You may.
Would this work? Employers should be allowed, if they choose, to contribute on behalf of their employees if the contribution does not subject the plan to ERISA requirements. Is that what you're...
I think it's redundant, that last part, because that's already stated that it can't be in conflict with ERISA. So the first part I like is acceptable.
Do we need to call out things like that at various places? Because I guess that would be the question around auto enrollment then as well, is do we need to call out which things for the legislature will be particularly...
doesn't the ERISA statement under later on encompass anything? We can make an inventory, but I don't know.
Right.
So
I guess that's the question, is do we have to call it out because that comes later? Do we need to call it out earlier so it's... Or how does that work?
Well, I was hearing Representative Leininger say you don't want this to be a poison pill that's in there if it's...
Yeah, thank you. Right. And I appreciate, because I feel like you included that last clause for my benefit, and I really appreciate that. You know, sometimes in contract drafting, there is a section in the contract that says, if there's anything in this contract that is in violation of law, then the contract shall be read to... not have that in it.
And severability clause.
Yeah, a severability clause. So, you know, maybe there's a way for us to include some sort of macro statement that these are the aspirations for content, and
we understand they may not all work.
And if they don't work, then we proceed as if they were not a barrier, because they will not be in. Or so, you know, something more.
That makes a lot of sense, and thank you for that perspective, because the legislature was very clear in their charge to us. So somewhere we need to make a blanket statement that we are assuming none of the things that are listed on these extensive lists of attributes are intended to violate what the legislature explicitly asked us to do. Right? We're making a good faith effort here with fairly minimal information.
So if we include a section like that, and Kristen can find something like that, or, you know, the team can, that would be sort of standard, then that will help us, I bet.
And just put it in with the next steps part?
Or
the ERISA question? Or right at the beginning? None of this is...
Maybe at the beginning, since that's such an umbrella overarching issue to all of this.
Okay. So, right. And I feel like to be the lone voice out here, but... voluntary is not necessarily a bad thing, and voluntary does get us away from ERISA rules in certain situations. So I know we would love to do automatic enrollment, and we realize the data supports that, but there is also a reason why a lot of employers still do voluntary today, and still have very high participation rate with voluntary. But once you do that automatic enrollment, it's going to come under ERISA at some level, and so how that ruling and how we write it will become pretty critical to that lady over there in the peach coat.
Can I make one non-ERISA, sure, ERISA-related suggestion?
Yeah, but I don't want to lose Harley's comment either. I want to give it the respect it's due. Dick,
Sorry. This is a separate
issue. Yeah, separate issue. Discussion on Harley's point.
Was Harley suggesting we not include to change the tenor of this entirely and say that we are not going to recommend discussing with DOL the mandatory enrollment?
I think we should
based on what I know of the DOL, based on my experiences with DOL on automatic enrollment and this language, it's pretty clearly written in ERISA, the rules around automatic enrollment and how to actually support that as an employer. And there's a lot of documentation you have to do. There's a lot of notices you have to do. And the reason why is to protect the participant. It's not, you know, the basis of the law is actually a good thing. It's there to help participants, protect participants, make sure they understand what's happening. But there are some due diligence you have to do with doing that. I'm just saying when you go to a voluntary, there's less of that burden that's being put out there. Really what do you want to get at the end of the day.
It's an entirely fair point in my estimation, Harley. May I make a suggestion?
Absolutely.
You are the proffer of the comment, so I will defer to you as to whether or not you think this accurately reflects the spirit of what you're doing. I'm just speaking for myself now. I saw compelling evidence that auto-enroll definitely encourages participation in programs and savings. And we saw examples in different contexts as well. I think somebody even mentioned an organ donor program, yep, and discussed absolutely the differences, yep, in enrollment. So it was kind of an interesting discussion by our behavioral economists. So I think it's an important characteristic to retain, but I agree with you that that's probably the biggest part of the biggest remaining question, which is the question of ERISA and the Department of Labor. Right. And I think it's entirely fair to reflect that reality in the commentary. So I won't put it as a dissent or recommend it as a dissent, mm-hmm, but I might recommend it as a significant cautionary note that this is one of the key issues that has to be addressed in our discussion of ERISA. Does that reflect your
and reflects the verbiage,
your educated concern about this?
Yeah.
Committee members, what do you?
I'm certainly accepting of that. I think that there is so much evidence that it would be that without automatic enrollment, it would be so much a weaker program as to not even be able to succeed at all.
I agree.
And the advantages of automatic enrollment are so
dramatic.
Obvious, I shouldn't, but have been demonstrated so broadly that we should make every effort, be as creative as we can be, involve us the smartest people we can find a way to make it work, if possible. If it doesn't work, then it doesn't. But that's my feeling on it.
I agree, or just speaking for myself, the auto-enroll piece, I thought, was one of the most clearly convincing and compelling parts of the testimony that we saw. I agree with that. But I can't escape the reality that we don't know the answer to the recent question.
That's
so
true.
We're repeating again. This is why we just need a blanket statement at the beginning. What did you call it? Severability?
Separability clause.
Separability clause.
It says if anything is found to be unlawful by a court of competent jurisdiction. Yep.
And that'll get it.
Good. And that part is nullified.
Good. Thank you. Any other comments on the characteristics?
Yes.
Dick?
Given what we heard today on the last bullet on page 31, can we substitute the word community for system for education?
Oh, yeah. The recommendations from the ARP testimony. Is that what you're referring
to? Yes, right.
Okay.
Then I think community reaches the broader context that was being suggested in the testimony. Then system would tend to refer just to the explicit education system.
Any objections?
I'm sorry, where are you, Richard?
Sorry?
I'm sorry, where?
We're on the second to the last line on page 31 that starts system to increase the public's, then will the board, instead it would read the board will work with the education community.
No.
They had mentioned including the public, the private sector, and the education system definition. Engage services in many community organizations dedicated to the quality of life of Oregonians. Is that about right? Good. Okay.
And then if I could also add, we heard some testimony and received a letter from a broad coalition of organizations suggesting specific examples or strategies around education and information. And I thought those were all good examples. And if I'd like to honor that testimony, if people have no objections, could we include that as examples of kinds of education and outreach program that were provided by public testimony? Yes. And Kristen, I'll get you that letter if you don't have that immediately available.
And yes. Can I add to that? I actually would like to get some of Bert's recommendation regarding trying to do some intact school programs. I'm in my testimony back to the response to this, which not much of it got in here. You know, there's a lot of data that's from, excuse me, I'm getting my notes. But I sat through a presentation from All Hands Raised a couple weeks ago, and they do a lot of research on, you know, our students in our schools and where they fail and at what point they fail. What was really compelling to me was, you know, there's enough data that says if kids aren't reading by third grade, they're most likely not going to pass high school graduation. If they're not passing eighth grade math, they're not going to pass high school education. I think it goes back to saving. I mean, if they're not saving by third or fourth grade or understand those concepts of what saving is, how to actually save, you know, back to what Edward talked about on feeling, we're missing a huge boat to try to get that population going, because to get out of part of this problem, it's not going to be us in this room. It's the people that will be starting school after Labor Day, that we got to get that group understanding what the power of saving, how to save, what's the mechanisms around it, doing some type of game type modeling where they're actually invested in it. I really think that is something we got to think about as a task force. I'm recommending back into this program, because you can't just do, you know, we all understand education only does so much, but you got to make that interactive piece. And based on what I heard from All Hands Raised, this definitely fits right into that.
Do you have some proposed language?
I don't have the exact proposed language, but I do think the current plans are hodgepodge. Some districts adhere to some of the nice plans done by the public. Some don't. It's not a priority. So it should be somehow worded to be a priority that the current educational plans for the community schools and the public should be reevaluated with the idea of values inculcated commercially for the general public. We do great things with commercials. We can get people to buy anything. Why not some of that money going towards the inspiration to, you know, the smart saver draft or something? It could be done, the values to the general public. And, of course, in the schools, there should be a standardized curricula. The private sector is happy to fund a lot of the programs, but they're hodgepodge. There should be a definite mandate and a definite curricula right through the schools. It's all the same, so everybody's on the same page. And how we address that here, it could be on part of the educational component, should be reevaluated in lieu of a standardized curricula that stresses the values, more modern than simply we taught a class. And the upper level, this is what happens, you might remember in school, the upper level kids who can read and can do a budget, and oh, they do great, and they sign up for retirement plans anyway, but it's the, if this task force has a relevance, it's to the people who don't, the marginal people, the ones that you want to get on with a simple plan that convince them that saving when they're down and out is worthwhile. And that's missed in the general classroom. Those are the kids that are left out and always have been.
There is, in the context of the report on page 28, there, it addresses the specific question that was asked in the statute about education marketing strategies. And there's reference to the standards that are currently in place. And I think we had those handed out to us in one of the earlier meetings, and there's a suggestion here that they could tie better together pieces that are already in the statutes, and they talk in the standards. The standards talk about financial literacy and have components about stocks, bonds, CDs, mutual funds, IRA, 401k, pension plans, and Social Security.
That's good for the A and B student. But as for the student who's marginal and hardly pays attention, I'm all for it, don't get me wrong, but there's got to be hands-on activities that make it real role-playing for everybody involved. And that has been missed in the public schools and has gone out since I taught it when it was popular 35 years ago.
Yeah, I'm not disputing that.
Yeah, I'm not disputing what you said either.
My concern is that if do we want to dive into the State Board of, well, whatever they call it, Oregon Education Investment Board now and start telling them how they should tell teachers to rearrange curricula, other than talking generally as in the proposed recommendations about the need to improve the education and tie into investment savings.
The 20 to 25% that don't sign up, even if there's matching funds and available, are just the ones that are left out of the current curricula to feel it and do it and improve it. And that's what we're trying to do, is get more people to save. Not necessarily have a new savings program to increase savings, but to get people to save on their own. So maybe we could just word something that's a little more adamant that the system has to be looked at.
I have a suggestion, actually, maybe that might meet your needs. Can you mind if I throw it out there?
Pardon me?
I have an idea that might capture what you're saying.
I love it.
And possibly what Harley's saying, too. So what I'm hearing is that we want to, without micromanaging what happens in classrooms, express our desire that people at a young age start hearing the important information about value of savings. So what if we added just this little parenthetical? Under the bullet that is an education component will make the public, that last bullet.
Mm-hmm.
If we add, comma, including school-aged Oregonians, comma, you know, so we're expressly calling out that our education component is not just folks who are 50 or 40 or 70, but, you know, an educational component will make the public, including school-aged Oregonians, aware of the importance of retirement savings.
And I wouldn't mind the word standardized being in there, so everybody does the same page, perhaps, same curricula. I mean, that's important. I've got
standardized in today's world.
Is a no-no word.
It's a political.
I know it doesn't go down well. And mandated sounds bad to an educator who says, I've got enough to do in the classroom already. But
Bert, your larger point is correct. And I just want to take this moment to put a historical footnote. We're not the first retirement savings task force impaneled by the state legislature.
They came up with the same
thing.
That's
correct. And the focus of their recommendations, they had different asks. The legislature asked them to do different things, but much of their energy was spent around financial literacy, programming, and planning, not only in the classroom, but also working through community organizations and private sector institutions like community banks and credit unions and such. And unfortunately, most of those recommendations were ignored. They just didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And by way of sort of an interesting historical continuation of that, the state treasurer was subsequently made a member of the State Board of Education for the purpose of raising the issue of financial literacy, and still nothing happened. I am pleased to say, and I just want to put out a commercial here for community banks and credit unions, they invest heavily in our state around all sorts of issues of financial literacy, and there's some phenomenal programs out there, but of course they only reach a small percentage of people, and even the state treasury sponsors a literacy program in elementary schools called Reading is an Investment. We reach several hundred schools across the state. But what would be helpful for me, and again, I apologize, Kristen, because I feel like all I do is load you up and load you up and load you up. The amazing Kristen, and this is just one committee meeting, there was national data released recently in the last couple of weeks about financial literacy. And what it said at the top line was that American kids
are far less educated on basic financial matters like credit and debt and those types of things than their foreign counterparts, yet young Americans are exposed to far more financial instruments at an earlier age. And so it's not just an Oregon problem, it's a national problem. But what I don't recall was where Oregon figured in those statistics and ranking, and maybe it wasn't there. I don't recall.
It was really low.
We were low. I think the legislature loves, the way to get them interested isn't to say we should have more education and information around retirement.
A suggestion.
One sec, Bert.
Sorry.
What we should do is get their competitive juices flowing and say, if what you say is correct, Elena, we're low. We're near the bottom of the pack in a state with a significant retirement security crisis. That makes the case for more interventive strategies around education, information, public relations, community organization outreach, whatever we need to do to create a coalition of support for what you're suggesting, Bert.
Would you suggest maybe recommending creating a separate board or committee or something?
As long as I don't have to chair it.
Me neither. I better not open my mouth or I'll be...
So the language we're settling on is we're going to do all these things, and Bert is going to offer to chair the committee.
Mm-hmm. I guess the one thing that I might include in this conversation is that while we can put a bunch of things about the school system, the schools aren't the only folks that are doing children's education or care about that.
That's right.
And so I think in adding the educational community, we are including a lot more of those statewide organizations, the neighborhood partnerships that are looking at child savings accounts, junior achievement, right, folks like that, that really are, they're paying attention to that national data, they're making big... there's a lot going on right now.
Can I make a plug in just because
since
I sit on the board of Junior Achievement, we did create a financial planning program for 9th and 10th graders. It's an iPad-based simulation program, and that would be the type of thing you want to get every Oregonian student through, right? Because it gives them the basic foundations of how to budget. What is savings? What are all these products? It goes over what's insurance, what is mortgages. It teaches those whole concepts, not independently, but in a holistic module. It's a 6-hour simulation that would at least move us closer to where we're trying to go.
I would second that plug. It's an amazing program. When we talk about how to help kids feel what it means to make these decisions, that program does that in a way that you see kids reacting much differently than if they're just sitting through it in a classroom and learning about it. They're not just learning about it there, they're actually applying it.
So Bert, I was being a little flip, but your comment was a serious one. This is clearly a separate issue unto itself. It's clearly related very importantly to the question of retirement security, but it's related to I'm working on a totally separate effort around things like student debt, completely in the center of the target for that, too. So maybe we should recommend a broader strategy or a deeper look at the overall issue of financial literacy and education in this state. I mean, what do you think, Ann? You're a legislator. Is that something the legislature would be responsive to?
A call for a broader look at the content of financial literacy education?
Well, the state of financial literacy, what we're doing, what works, what partnerships are already out there in the community, and what role the state could play in helping to elevate that discourse.
You know, I think those are important needs. I just think we are trying to do a whole lot already in this document, and we also have a huge number of boards and commissions already in the state. I think it's very reasonable to call out, school age, financial literacy training for people who are school age and the need for it to be good and effective. But I would, I guess, we're trying to take on so much here already. I would not do a whole bunch more than that in this document, because everything we're addressing from a fairly high level point. So it doesn't disrespect the importance of that issue by similarly addressing that at a high level, you know, acknowledging that there's work to be done fleshing out that and fleshing out a whole bunch of meaningful issues that we raise. So
I agree.
Can I offer an additional observation?
Yes, please, Dick.
On when we get to next steps, I mean, just sort of a sneak preview, it says, and the task force should, given that the task force doesn't sunset until January 2, 2017, that it continues and that it should continue to facilitate the creation and establishment of the program. And that could include this kind of monitoring.
You know what? And so I like that. And I also like you've proposed throwing in some examples of ways that education could look. What if we also included among those a reference to the fact that the Junior Achievement Program, you know, is also a great example of how financial literacy works for people in that age group. So,
right.
I think it's all great, except so many poorer communities and such don't have any of these programs available. Junior Achievement's Wonderful Future, Business Leaders of America, all that stuff I've been active with.
It's true.
So Bert's comment is, if I'm understanding you correctly, so please correct me if I'm not, your concern isn't just about the general state of financial literacy. You have an express concern about kids who are currently falling through the cracks who might be particularly tough to reach out to on this subject. Is that a fair restatement?
Definitely, because they tend to be the ones who don't sign up for retirement plans when there's even matching funds. They're the ones that come from, as I mentioned in my presentation, they come from a background where the work ethic hasn't been there, and so obviously the savings effort hasn't been there either, and somehow to get to them, that simplistic, very simplistic unit that I presented, we get more kids feeling and remembering at an early age. And I don't think it has to be overly complicated, just a series of values-oriented role-playing episodes in young people's lives that can make them think. So when the opportunity is there, they'll go for the brass ring on the merry-go-round when the opportunity is presented.
Can I offer a suggestion?
Please.
What if we added an additional appendix that identified the variety of education programs like Junior Achievement and others? I mean, there's some reference in the text of the document, but if we could, for the convenience of the legislature when they're thinking about this, they could see a, wouldn't necessarily be comprehensive, you know, all-inclusive, comprehensive, but it would give
a list of four
page
examples.
Full of examples of things that could be attached to any few further development of the education piece.
I'd go for that. I don't think it has to be a big revamping of the whole system as much as just the right courses at the right time to leave an impression.
Okay. Thanks, Bert. Any other issues under characteristics before we move on?
Thank you.
Thank you, Bert. Any dissent? All right. We'll assume we're done with characteristics and that is approved. Governance and management. So this got edited and then it got re-edited, and I think I'll just let it stand as it is, and we'll see what people think about it as they read it.
I guess my biggest question was, how does this compare? Like, is this a similar model or similar requirements that the 529 plan had? Is that kind of what that it's modeled after, that board?
Best I could say is sort of.
Yeah, I mean, it's approximately correct. The 529 College Savings Board has other characteristics that are specific to to education and to college savings. But yeah, that's generally accurate.
can just make the point, then I'll just freak
out. Harley, you had a comment.
Reading through this, my biggest concern is, as I read it, it jumps out to me as pretty basic fiduciary positions. And when you talk about fiduciary, then you talk about liability. So it sort of goes directly in conflict with what the legislation asked us not to do, which was take on more liability for state of Oregon. So the way this is written, and the picking out fund management, picking out policies, investment fund managers, all that talks about fiduciary liability that the state would be taking on.
Kristen, at some point, or Jan, at some point a long time ago, I asked for a definition of what was meant in the legislation under the question of liability. Was it general liability, financial liability, liability under ERISA? Does anybody remember?
Yeah, the statute says liability for any, or guarantee, I think guarantee for any funds or returns on funds.
So to avoid the PERS issue, in other words. Yeah. Is that an accurate? Does anybody know?
The statute's right at the back here. It says may not recommend plans or products that would subject the state of Oregon or private sector employers to responsibilities under ERISA, or that would result in tax treatment that's less favorable. Plans or recommend plans or products that would create any guarantee by the state or cause the state to incur any liability or obligation for payment of savings or benefits earned by plan participants.
So, Harley, my read is that's not in conflict.
Okay.
Any other comments under governance or management? Anything we should have included that we did not include? Any objections? All right. Next steps, and I want to warn you, it looks like there's only one next step because of the way we format. If you flip the page, it gets rather long very quickly. So take some time here and read all of the pages associated with that.
You know what? Never mind.
You're looking for tax credits?
I thought I
used
this on sheets, but I haven't. Yeah. Okay.
Include some of the points that John had made on the specific tax incentives.
On the second page, under request that the legislature considering offering tax credits to offset the cost of employers, would that be the right place to include that, Harley? On page 33, bullet point 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
And we're talking about including something about tax credits to the savers.
To the individuals as well.
The individuals. Okay. I'd agree with that.
I have one concern.
Yes.
I mentioned earlier when the issue of tax credits came up that would exclude all the tax-exempt organizations, which tend to be the smaller employers. And so if the recommendation is to explore offering tax credits, there should be some recognition that there's a sizable number of small employers that would not have that available to them. And then we don't want to set up something where the for-profit small employer would get a tax credit and the nonprofit tax-exempt organization would not, because that would be counterintuitive, I think, or a disincentive.
Yeah, if your goal is to offset the cost to the organization, it should be.
How about if we said something like, request that the legislature consider offering tax credits or comparable incentives to offset the cost to employers. That, you know, the or comparable kind of encompasses that there are some tax-exempt entities for whom tax credits isn't helpful. And then maybe we could add to that language that you know, per Harley's comment, something like, and incentives to potential savers. You know, I mean, my own feeling is it's more important to incentivize modest income, low income earning people than people in other parts of the income spectrum. But that's a, you know, we're deferring some questions for another day. So I would be willing to add incentives to potential savers. You know.
Yeah, and if we could add as examples, the two examples that were offered during testimony today as examples that were provided during testimony.
Right.
Just to capture that for the record. Mm-hmm.
Does that meet your...
And tweak it so it encompasses the...
Right, so or comparable incentives.
Tax exempting.
Right. Yeah.
So in a meeting I attended yesterday with some small business owners, I promised that we would put on our list of things to do a clear statement that we will evaluate the cost and the administrative requirements specific to small business. And I don't know if that's already encompassed here somewhere, but I'd like to make sure it's included as a specific task of exploration.
I think it's...
thought I saw it.
I thought I did too.
It's in there, but you got to sort of expand it a little bit.
Where do you see it, Harley?
Well, that's the middle of the page.
Oh, that's
fine. Fourth bullet down.
Oh, yes. There it is, right in the middle.
Ah, there we go.
Yeah. Thought I saw that.
Not just direct costs, though. There were
it's
other,
also the indirect. And
yeah, direct right. And indirect costs would make me happy that I feel like I've fulfilled my commitment. Because that's a key issue, and I know Jan had testified that that's a key issue for the people that she and others represent. Mm-hmm.
And we don't really mention it in our areas, but, you know, the MyRA to try to get going, you know, maybe something simpler that we can, as a state, support, and at least as other things are being worked out, at least you're supporting something that could happen now versus, you know, a year or 2 years from now.
Yeah, good point, Harley. During the testimony, I'd made a couple of comments here. And I don't know whether they go in the recommendations or whether they go in the body of the report. I think it's material and important to the legislature to know about MEPS and MIRA and that those are on the offing and will color the conversation going forward. And so I feel like at least the body of the report, the data part, if not the recommendations, should include a discussion of that, what's going on at the federal level.
There's a blank appendix page that talks about what the federal government is doing, and that's where...
Okay, well, let's make a note to do that, because I think that's important. And I just found the comment that was made today about the cost to small business, that there's the direct cost, but then also time and liability were specifically mentioned, and I thought the liability piece was interesting.
So organized.
We heard Tesla.
On the MyRA.
MyRA.
Thank you. If an employer chooses that, then they are providing something to their employees at that point, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That would be my read. Any disagreements with that?
Okay. It's been a long day.
You just said something, and everyone agreed, and could you didn't say hear it again?
No, I can't say I couldn't speak.
Harley's like, what's wrong with you people? It must be a long day.
I started at 5 today.
Okay, so
anything
else anybody wants to add to next steps?
For an employer,
maybe a statement or kind of a question.
Sure.
Looking
yes,
at bullet point two.
An employer offers.
Requested appropriation from the legislature to fund a request for information RFI to ask financial firms whether they currently provide retirement savings plans with the attributes described in the characteristics earlier. this information will be provided to the board, which we actually haven't defined who's on the board yet, called for the governance and management section above, which will use the information to make findings, whether there's adequate market capacity and interest in providing this type of retirement savings plan to Oregonians. Now, if this is the plan we're talking about, then is there a possibility the board decides hell with it? It doesn't fit. Do I read that right? If they can't get the... Whether there's adequate market capacity, I would suspect would be people interested in participating.
Yeah, so let me tell you what the spirit of that is, and if it's poorly worded, we can rework it. We received much testimony, written and oral, some of it, suggesting that there needs to be a more thorough understanding of what, you know, we have now agreed on these various characteristics.
Yeah.
Now the question is, what's out there that already meets these characteristics?
Private sector, perhaps.
Correct. And if there's nothing out there, what obstacles currently exist that make it hard for the private sector or impossible for the private sector to address those particular characteristics that we're seeking?
Got you.
And so, and that was, I'm basically combining four or five different conversations I had with various people who are already in the sector, who say there's lots and lots of plans that probably already meet the criteria. We don't know the answer to that question. So this is a good way to engage the private sector. There are lots of private sector partners out there who are interested in participating in an RFI process. Sure. If we pursue one, it seems like a relatively sensible strategy. And I'd be particularly interested, if I were reading, to understand what are the obstacles that could be leading to the 50% not getting access through their place of employment. That would be interesting, because there are probably some obstacles that government has created that I think the legislature needs to know about.
Yeah.
And that would help us get to it. So that was the intent, whether we worded it exactly right. If not, that's sort of my fault.
It almost looked like that things could come to a halt right there if they didn't find it. Just the way it was worded, so I got it.
Yeah, well, then maybe we'll take a swing at that, just to make sure that the spirit of it is exactly as I'm suggesting.
Chair,
yes.
May I pivot?
Yeah,
back,
please.
To where we were before?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the idea of a my RA is a helpful thing, but you know, with the ceiling of that being $15,000, it's really not at all a substitute for meaningful retirement savings, right? So I guess we, while I was talking, and I apologize for that, sort of as a body concluded that an employer offering a my RA, maybe I'm misunderstanding this, that offering a my RA would be enough to satisfy the aspirations of our task force. But I just want to be clear that offering a MyRA so that someone can save $15,000 is really a radically different thing from giving someone a path to getting to $300,000, $500,000, $900,000, which is really where we're hoping that Oregonians will be closer to by the time they retire. So do we really want to say expressly, I mean, maybe the legislature decides that, but do we right now want to expressly say that we think that having a MyRA plan is synonymous with dealing with this issue?
Well, it's the way my brain's working is it starts them saving, right? So if we're focused on getting people to save,
right.
It addresses that issue, right?
It does start.
And, you know, based on the testimony earlier today, I believe they will have a process for how do you roll that into an IRA, a Roth IRA, and have that vehicle available going forward, you know, just like anyone else would. It's just going to be a different, it'll be individual account versus under a plan. That's what I'm probably predicting that they will come out with.
I guess I would proffer, and I think, you know, reasonable people can have different positions on this. I guess I would put it more as flagging the issue to the legislature, you know, do you want to have offering a MyRA
constitute satisfaction of an employer-based retirement program. Some might say, some people in the legislature might say, gosh darn it, that's a nice thing, but that's a far cry from offering a plan that's going to a portable something
right,
that people can have forever that gets them to retirement.
Yeah, if I may, you know, we've established these characteristics, and by the way, I'd like to open that conversation up for a minute because I feel like we've forgotten one. But the you could basically create a grid with these characteristics and then ask what fits within these characteristics, and you could grade them based on that. I mean, how?
I guess.
To my idea, you know, I don't know enough yet about the MIRA and how it works. It probably does not meet all of the criteria that have been laid out, but again, it doesn't necessarily mean we would want to discourage it. It's
yeah. What we talked about in the characteristics, the threshold is to make something available where workers do not have access to an employer-sponsored plan. So that takes away everybody that has one.
Right.
And it seems to me that if employer offers my RA, then the employee would have access and would not be covered by what we're talking about.
Any of the rest
about.
Of what
well,
we're doing.
I guess that's right. I guess that's right.
Good point.
So do we want to be there, I guess? Do we want to exempt from all this opportunity everybody whose employer gives them access to a MyRA through which they can save up to $15,000? Do we as a body want to make that decision? Do we want to flag that as a crucial decision for the legislature?
Yeah, it's a good question. Is that is that going to be our, excuse me, our definition of, I mean, because there'd be lots of definitions, but is that going to be the limit of our definition of an employer-sponsored retirement plan is one that maxes out at $15,000.
Right.
Because I think that what Ann's asking is really important, is that right. There can be lots of things that sort of, I mean, AFLAC might be considered by some people to be that. They could call it that. And I don't think that maxing out at $15,000 would meet what I would consider a employer-sponsored retirement plan.
Well, from what I understood from the testimony, if you once they hit that ceiling, then there's some characteristic that moves them into
that's what
something
they,
that we already
they
know.
Hope to do someday. The plan is to have something further, and so if whatever else they create after MIRA does do that, and if there's I guess it would be as yet to be determined whether the package that includes MIRA and this other yet undeveloped thing would meet what we would define as an employer-sponsored retirement plan.
My reaction to all that is that I'm very worried about getting into the thicket of what employers currently offer for retirement plans. And if an employer selects without judging the wisdom of the plan that the employer selects, or rather than sit in judgment of the wisdom of the employer selection, I think the charge we have is to look at those that do not have access.
And I think, so maybe to Ann's point, is looking at flagging this and just making folks aware that
there's troublesome characteristics.
Should an employer choose the MIRA, there's the potential that it caps at 15, and we don't know what happens after that at this point in time. We understand there will be some way to roll them into another, some other kind of retirement plan or get them connected to a Roth IRA or whatever it is. We don't know what that looks like yet, and so we also can't pass judgment on whether that's going to be adequate for the long-term savings in retirement either. I guess I don't feel confident in it.
Seems like one option would be just staying silent on the issue, because maybe people disagree about whether MyRA is an employer-sponsored retirement plan. Maybe we don't have to expressly say that it is, and we don't have to debate whether it is, but maybe we could just stay silent on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because
That could be
you know, because if we're trying to avoid the thicket of what constitutes an employer-sponsored retirement plan, maybe we stay silent and then leave that for people to battle about at another time. But I kind of think that what happened when I was talking is that we expressly determined that it was one. And then
well,
that takes us down the
yeah,
rails.
You know what, that's fair. So maybe let me suggest this, Anne. Maybe I still think that the MEP and the MIRA need to be in the body of the report
sure.
as serious federal efforts that are being undertaken, and maybe in the body of the report we can list the details, including the $15,000 cap, if that's in fact the right cap, and leave that there in the body of the report. Is that acceptable to people?
Sure. Yes.
Okay, I would like to add another characteristic, and I can't believe we did not add this, and I don't know how this fell out of our drafts. And I hope there's not a tremendous amount of debate, but I'm certainly willing to undertake it. Pooled and professional management of the funds. Pooled because it reduces the cost. Professionally managed because there's a large body of evidence that we're aware of that shows that's the way to go. Is there any disagreement about including that under characteristics?
Not at all.
Thank you, and I apologize. Harley, you don't think it should be professionally managed. Why not?
So how do you define pooled?
The more resources you can combine into one pot, the lower your administrative costs.
Which is similar to your 529.
Correct.
So that type of concept.
Correct.
Yeah.
Good. Thank
professionally
you.
Managed, not by the state?
I think we've left that as an open question, that if we do an RFP process, I think there are people who would like the state to participate in that open competitive process. And that's why we were discussing a state-sponsored program as not necessarily being the state.
Thanks.
Any further, did I get all the categories? We got them all, right?
I've got one thing that I'll, and it's maybe technical.
Yeah, sure. That's fine. And that's Go for it. We have time, believe it or not.
To verify that the program is not subject to the federal ERISA, the Office of Treasurer should coordinate and pursue with other states engaged in similar efforts for identification of common questions and establishing such state-sponsored programs. So, what I don't know, and maybe you know, or maybe it's still open, is whether what the DOL accepts is just broad common questions, in which case it makes perfectly good sense, or whether what DOL will say is, I need to see your plan before I'm going to, DOL, before we are going to render an opinion. Because if it's the former, I think it makes perfectly good sense. If it's the latter, our plan is likely to be different, I would predict, from every other state, and so we would get lost if we try to pool plans, you know, if we get real involved in how our plan might or might not be different from another state. So does anyone know whether DOL is likely to rule on broad common questions as opposed to our plan?
Good question. We heard testimony from the California folks and the Department of Labor, and it was indeterminate. So
okay.
Maybe what we say, add the two words, if practical.
Okay. Right.
Nice.
Okay.
Can I go off one other thing?
Yeah, sure.
So, one of the other characteristics I don't think we call out strong enough is just overall marketing of retirement savings in general and how, you know, similar like we've done with the education program, some other programs. I don't see us specifically calling that out as part of what we're doing. So I don't know if I missed it or...
Does it fall under the education component?
No,
it's separate.
It's separate.
Separate. So marketing...
You know, just that campaign type marketing, you know, building awareness and throughout the state.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. We could either put it in characteristics or we could put it under governance and management as a role of the board. the 529 board is responsible for PR, marketing, outreach. We could add that as a bullet point if you want under that, or really wherever you prefer.
It'd be fine.
Is that okay?
Mm-hmm. Since you raised the additional bullet about under characteristics, we need to include, I hesitate to suggest this, but in the list that we include the term self-sustaining. It was pooled and professional management of funds.
What do you mean self-sustaining in this context?
That whatever's created takes care of its own needs.
Right.
For
it'll need a critical mass to survive without tapping the state.
So it just could be inserted in that one that came up about pooled and professional management of funds.
So could you add specific language to give it context, please?
Pooled, professional managed.
Self-sustaining means lots of things. So it is self-sustaining from a financial perspective?
Operational.
Operationally self-sustaining.
Yeah.
Self-sufficiency that it...
Well, let me back up.
Yeah.
I think what I understood, and maybe I'm a lone thinker in this, that what we were talking about and the information we had about what's going on in other states and the testimony we had from California, that we were thinking that what we were talking about was an enterprise that would take care of itself without having to call on the state to give it lots of money.
So, in other words, no general fund dollars coming in to support it. It operates out of its own funds, like the 529 mm-hmm. program or the state.
Yeah, if that may be subsumed under the what the board does, I don't. But I guess the question is, do we need to?
I'd rather it be a separate bullet point, separate from pooled and professionally managed, because that just refers to the funds that are actually assets of the program.
Okay.
Any objections?
The program would be self-sustaining.
Right. Objections?
That's good.
Good. Okay. So we now have all of our... We didn't actually take a vote on next steps. I need to do that, or Jan's going to poke my ribs. Any objections to the next steps as we've drafted them? Okay, so we have agreed to pages 31 to 33 as written. We'll clean it up. We'll clean up the rest of the document. We'll wait on people to submit any additions or tweaks. If there's things that we've forgotten, we'll add them. The MIRA and the MEPS and whatever else, you're going to work with John to add some of the contextual information that we neglected to put in. Sorry about that, John, and we do appreciate the testimony. And if within 2 weeks people could get back their edits to Jan, then we will start working on that. Kristen, again, thank you very, very much for your efforts on this. I know it's a ton of work coming at once. I want to thank the members of this task force. We have not had a lot of meetings. We had a very short time frame, and we have a very serious waypoint next month. And I want to appreciate your forbearance. I want to thank you for all of the reading that you have done. I want to thank all the people who came and participated in these meetings. I think it was extremely helpful to have people come in and express differences of opinion and ideas. I personally feel like I've learned a ton. In a very short period of time. We'll present this information to the legislature in some form at their request in September, and we'll take it from there. So unless there's anything else for the good of the order, Ann?
I want to thank you, because you wouldn't get to that part of the remarks. So I want to thank you for courageous leadership on this, helping us find a path forward in a pretty ambiguous situation, and finding ways, I think, to meaningfully incorporate input and concerns from a really wide range of people. I think that was really good job facilitating, so thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Ann. I appreciate it. Great. Without further ado, we're adjourned. Thank you. Without further ado, we're adjourned. Thank you. Without